Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai haere mai ke te Indigenous Urbanism, Aotearoa Edition, Episode 13. I'm your host, Jay Kake, and this is Indigenous Urbanism, stories about the spaces we inhabit and the community drivers and practitioners who are shaping those environments and decolonizing through design. On this episode of Indigenous Urbanism, we speak with Kevin O'Brien, an Indigenous architect practicing in Brisbane, Queensland, Australia. Kevin belongs to the Meriam and Kurrareg peoples of the Torres Strait, a group of islands located in northeastern Australia. To kick off, could you tell me who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
My name's Kevin O'Brien. I'm a descendant of the Kurrareg and Meriam people from the Torres Strait. I'm an architect practicing in Brisbane, and I'm Professor of Creative Design at the University of Sydney.
How did this kind of relationship and collaboration internationally start, and how has this kind of sharing and dialogue influenced your practice?
Okay, so I think this set of relationships that I've developed for me taken almost 20 years to happen. It started with a guy called Rui Thompson up in Auckland, but we actually met in Sydney at a student conference back in the late 90s, and at the time, I was working with one other Aboriginal man in Australia, also in Sydney, another architect. And at the time, we were the only two. And then we met Rui, and we thought, oh, maybe there's three of us. And we hadn't at any point really looked outside of where we were in Sydney. We were quite young at the time, and we're just trying to get by. And then as we met Rui, we met other people over here. And then slowly but surely, over the last 20 years, it's been this sort of dripping, 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 and the dripping's turning into a bit more of a flow now. And then finally, sort of early 2000s, we started to meet people up in Canada and the States, and the network sort of started to, you know, it was nice and social and easy, and it's just sort of grown and grown. And then I think in the last 12 months, it hit some kind of tipping point, which was fantastic because it ended up in a really big sort of critical mass between Australia, New Zealand and Canada. You know, one of the fruits of that growing is, I think, this book that's just about to be published.
Something that is a pretty, a recurring theme between our countries being settler colonial nations is this real tension between rural and haukainga, like home communities, that might be quite geographically isolated from the urban centres where a lot of our people now live. So I'm just wondering, how do you kind of navigate that as an architect, and how your approaches might be different on country versus being in these colonised cities?
Yeah, I think in the Australian setting, we've got a quilt work of Aboriginal countries across the continent. And then in understanding that, then it's easier to understand the two roles or the two hats we wear as architects, because one is as a professional architect in the modern sense, but there's something that informs that in terms of an obligation as an Aboriginal man, and that is that you have expectations and cultural obligations, and one of them is to understand precisely what country you're standing on before you do anything. And once you're aware of that as a starting point, it does two other things. One is it helps you to look inside yourself and understand who you are, but more importantly, you can only really do that if you have genuine relationships with the people of that place. So once those things are kind of set out and they develop over time as well, the architecture can then be enabled and followed. So what I tend to find is when I'm observing other people and other architects and how they practice, they tend to strike difficulty when they don't have those relationships, or they don't know themselves, or they try to impose work onto a community or onto a place.
And they imagine maybe sometimes a cultural blankness, I think, that comes with being, you know, colonising group?
To be honest, it's not bound to one culture or the other. I've seen this fellow Aboriginal people and also non-Aboriginal people. Mm. And it's not one easily explained, but in my experience I've seen some of that occur purely out of almost a lack of maturity, but someone who's in the process of maturing and they're finding out, or starting from a point of naivety, but they're on a search to get to another place. And inevitably mistakes get made. You learn from those and move on. But in terms of like when I encounter it in a colonizing sort of capacity, or in my way of trying to figure out how to decolonize it, it's obviously complex because the relationship is one that has a lot of trauma attached to it historically, but equally the challenge then becomes, how do you move beyond, I guess, a state of victimhood where you can get stuck and never, you know, you just can't move beyond things. And I think that's the really big challenge at the moment.
I've never been fortunate enough to visit any of your buildings, but I have seen you present a few times. And one of the projects that really struck me was a health centre in somewhere, I think, that was quite remote. I don't remember exactly where it was, but you had some really interesting ideas about trauma and healing and how culture might influence the way spaces for health and healing are designed.
Yeah, I think the project you might be referring to was a medical service in Casino in northern New South Wales.
Oh, that's not that remote. I grew up near there.
Yeah, it's regional.
Yeah, there we go.
In the Australian sense, because it's
not the city.
Yeah, it's northern New South Wales. It's in Bundjalung country, and it's fourth or fifth medical service I've worked on. But in terms of working with the community and understanding that country and their histories and their place, and trying to find something that gives you a some moments of inspiration or things to draw upon or things to develop with people. The one thing that kind of struck me about that place was just how amazingly beautiful and generous the people were. But in the face of that, there is some incredibly traumatic history with frontier wars and some of the most brutal massacre sites in the state in that area. You know, you'd be forgiven if you met people who harboured a lot of hate, and that's not what I've found. I've found a lot of people who kind of were generous and had carried a lot of love, but there was a sense, I think, of melancholy behind the eyes. And I just thought, particularly when I work on this building, there was a couple of things going. One is that you have to make the architecture respond to people or be a setting or a background for the things they need to make happen or stage. The second was to figure out how to make materials come from that place or that country to have sort of an imbued connection. And then the third was like trying to figure out how to then bend all of those things and give another sense of identity. And that thing I usually look for in either a work of art or working with artists or affecting something in that space myself. And in this one, the thing that ended up becoming the mediator of all of that was this brick. It was a brick that was made out of that land, or out of that earth from that country. And it was a fired brick. So it had this fantastic reference to fire and how that was used to manage landscape. But in clipping the bricks, we're able to give a quality to one of the elevational treatments where we thought about it in terms of the loss that people didn't necessarily express overtly but was there, and the loss that men feel as opposed to the loss that women feel. And these two fields of brick pattern were either side of a window that was framed in gunmetal, framed a view of the local Catholic church. And it was in one move was trying to reset that, but also acknowledge what was a pretty nasty relationship in the past, but place it into this facility that was all to do with healing, but then also use the material in a way that water would hit it and it would start crying and you'd have this tear mark down it. So the thing is, I've always understood that you can't really start healing till you've shed a tear or two. So that became part of the idea. And then the brick itself organises the plan and pops up in the middle as a courtyard for the staff. So they have this absolutely direct connection to country through that material, and also the native garden that inhabits it. So they have a place of tranquility, somewhere to recuperate from like daily trauma with community and, you know, all the intensities that come with that. So yeah, it's an interesting building, that one.
I remember when I heard you speak once, you talked about where you're from, and you talked about, I think it was your uncle's house being pinned down from above.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a bit more about that? I just thought it was an amazing story.
Oh yeah, so the house or the hut or the shed you're talking about, there's an uncle's place out at Miriam. It's in the Murray Island Group out east in the Torres Strait, but few of very fortunate occasions I've been able to get there. I got to see this amazing shed structure, and this is a guy who's not in any way trained as an architect, but in terms of the kind of thinking and the absolute sort of rationalist and pragmatic approach to making a dwelling, this thing is one of the most amazing things I've seen. And it starts by being incredibly free. It makes, in my way of thinking, it makes a wind block, it makes protection from the sun, and then in terms of making sure the thing doesn't blow away, it then pins it down by filling these drums with sand and sticking them on the top. And it kind of makes sense when you think of it as expending the least amount of energy to make a dwelling. This is it. And then it just has this fantastic sort of scale to it. It's a few posts and beams, and they are incredibly minimal, and they are exactly where they need to be because the length of the sheet's that length, and that's it.
Very simple, very pragmatic, very suited to place. And these are all, I guess, kind of things that architects often strive for, and sometimes it's a bit ironic that actually communities often have these solutions.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it becomes part of, well, it's certainly affected the way I think, because it as a dwelling isn't the purpose of inhabiting that beach. It's just something you retreat back to. So the rest of the setting along the beach edge and the trees and the water and all these things is the extended part of the daily existence and, you know,
so you really
program of events.
Inhabit and have a relationship with that landscape.
That's right, yeah. And the building itself just supports that. It doesn't become the focus of it.
The primary relationship isn't with the building.
Correct. Yeah.
Kevin developed the idea of finding country in an independent exhibition, which was shown at the 2012 Venice Architecture Biennale. The Radical Project sought to recover Aboriginal country from the Australian city and addresses questions of urban settlement and territory in colonial Australia. We asked Kevin to talk about the Finding Country project and the significance and applicability of this idea to Australian cities and other colonial spaces.
If the building's at one end of the scale of action, at the other end is how we start to look at the city as a much bigger thing, and especially the kind of cities that have landed on us in Australia and New Zealand and Canada, and because they're kind of new world cities, I guess. But there's a whole, in the history of architecture, you know, in the way we were taught, there's a whole series of, you know, Italian architects who were focused on thinking about the ruins of Rome as the origins of their new beginnings of refinding the golden periods of Rome in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And in a similar way, I guess I've been thinking about country in the Australian context, and or in the Aboriginal context of the thing you belong to as being built on and over, and what happens when, what's a city look like if you start with important things in country and said, well, actually that thing can't be built on or over, and you may build around it or beside it, but not across it. And the ceremonies and rituals and social settings that need to occur with it then become the things that generate the new form of an imagined city. So it doesn't become a blueprint for the rolling out across the whole city, but in terms of an attitude, it means if we know there's something in some part of the city that needs to be not restored and not conserved, it has to be extended, then I think in a way it's almost recovered, but it has to be, I think, certainly in the historical sense, it has to be extended and it must have an effect on the city. Equally, there's other contemporary modern occupations of Aboriginal people in the city, and they take the forms of medical services and all these sorts of things, and they are as much a part of keeping the social interactions alive on country as well.
And I guess having this approach that really recognises cultural heritage but doesn't sit it in stasis, and also thinks about equally valuing present day occupation and usage. Yeah.
The way I've been exploring this idea for the last 10 years is sitting, working on exhibitions and studios, and there's this idea where I give people or students a grid out of the street directory and ask them to imagine half the population gone and therefore to empty half of their drawing with a view of revealing some idea about that bit of the city by acknowledging country. And because it's been going for 10 years now, the complexity in the thinking's becoming really impressive and forces everyone to kind of look not at the edges of the city but back into the centre. Because, you know, as architects are trained to, here's a blank piece of paper, here's a pencil, build your creation, go to the edge of the city, off you go. And same with planners and people in urban design. So when you're forced to actually put a hold on the boundary and just go back and look at all the mess that's been created and all the opportunities that have been missed, it forces everyone to put a value on everything and to see things very differently.
Think about it really critically.
Yeah.
Now, I heard that as part of this project, you had a large-scale display of the pieces of the street directory created, you know, this project created a large vision. Now, I heard you set on fire.
Yeah,
what's
so
that about?
The big drawing, the first iteration, was actually in Melbourne in a gallery. Then there was this in 2009, and then there was a second in Venice in 2012 for the Biennale, and then we did one in 2015, I think it was, in Los Angeles, and then another one back in Venice last year. But probably the one in 2012 was the first one I burnt. We burnt those parts of the street or the big drawing that hadn't been changed or affected by people's contributions. So it was those bits of the drawing that were just left as is that don't have regular fire management. So it got fire managed on the night, and it was just part of the performative work, I guess, to make people understand how fire is used as an agent of change and keeping things in a productive state.
And it's not just destruction but also creation.
It's never destruction. It's always keeping things productive. So it's just moving things on to the next cycle. Destruction's when you don't fire it because things just fall into a state of disrepair and can't be used. Fire's a tool. It's got to be seen as that. And I think the unfortunate thing in Australia is the understanding around fire is mostly through fear. I mean, I think in Queensland, it's one of the more advanced states in terms of firing in off seasons and trying to control fuel sources. But somewhere like Victoria, which really struggles and to get their head around it, and then, you know, they end up with no fires. But then when they do get one, it's a catastrophic one. They're just deadly and they bring all sorts of pain and destruction. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that maybe comes back from such a cultural basis of thinking of the land as something to be conquered or resisted or managed, rather than kind of understanding that it's a relationship and there's give and take in that relationship.
Yeah, I think it's that. It's also just a different attitude to the land. So one is when you belong to something, then you become part of its cycle in a way that keeps it productive, which therefore keeps you alive, and that's where the relationship lies. When So I think in the opposite condition, the opposite of country city, and that's all to do with ownership and Torrens title, and here's the building you own, and therefore because of this being your property that you own, there's rules and regulations that come with that, and one of them is you don't light fires wherever you feel like it, and all of a sudden it changes the way the landscape performs or needs to perform.
You can find out more about Kevin and the Finding Country project at findingcountry.com.au and at koarchitects.com.au. Our interview with Kevin was recorded on location at Ngā Te Kore, the second International Indigenous Designers' Hui hosted by Ngā Ahu in March 2018. Kevin is also one of the editors and contributors to a new book entitled Our Voices, Indigeneity and Architecture, edited by Rebecca Kittle, Patrick Stewart, and of course, Kevin O'Brien. Our Voices, Indigeneity and Architecture is an exciting advance in the field of architecture, offering multiple Indigenous perspectives on architecture and design, theory and practice. Indigenous authors from Aotearoa New Zealand, Canada, Australia and the USA explore the making and keeping of places and spaces which are informed by Indigenous values and identities. We spoke with Rebecca Kittle, Nō Ngāti Porou me Ngāpuhi, one of the three editors and initiators of this project.
Myself, amongst a wide group of others, have been involved in this publication, Our Voices, Indigeneity and Architecture, of which you are one of the editors. So I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about how that project was initiated and where we're at currently.
So the project really was initiated because of another book, and another book that was led by non-Indigenous academics to start with. Eventually, Indigenous academics were involved in the editorship. The fact that it was led by non-Indigenous people is not necessarily problematic per se, except that there had originally been no thought given to involving Indigenous people in that editorial role. And of course, we know that those who have power to decide what's written have power to shape stories. And so a number of us took that on board and thought, well, actually, it's about time we started telling our own stories. And it came to a head when a few of us, including you and me, went to North America and met up with a number of First Nations architects there and Kevin O'Brien from Australia. And we started having conversation about this, about is it time to write our own book, to have our own voices heard? And we decided, yes, it was time. So we decided we would write our own book, and it's aptly named Our Voices, Indigeneity and Architecture, to convey the fact that it's written by a wholly Indigenous authorship from Canada, North America, Australia and New Zealand, and actually a whole range of different voices in terms of practitioners, academics, community people are represented in that book. There's actually our youngest author is a young man called Matthew Groom, who is one of the students that we worked with at Aotea College for the Imagining Decolonized Cities project, and his entry into the Imagining Decolonized Cities project is in the book because it was an essay, a beautiful essay, written as if he were the whenua, so as if he were the land. He tells the story about him being the sort of papakainga whenua, and it's a beautiful piece, and so he's also on the book. But you also get different types of writing. You get an academic style of writing, you get sort of memoir type works, you get zines, which apparently, according to the young people, means like a sort of magazine-y type way of writing. You get blog entries. Yeah, so it's a very varied book in terms of style. It's very varied in terms of content. There are very strong common themes, though, that run through the book. There's obviously quite a lot of pain represented in the book, lots of people talking about very painful kind of memories and experiences of having been subjugated or having had families and tribal histories that have not been recognised in whatever land that they are in. So yeah, I think it's a really fabulous book, but I might say that under the editors. But yeah, just really, it's very eclectic potentially, but also rich set of stories.
Now, I've heard that it's envisioned that it's the first and with more to come. A little bit about what's next.
Sure. So the plan is that, yes, this is the first volume of many. The idea being that if there's any profit from this book, it will go back into a sort of publishing collective that will support Indigenous publishers, Indigenous people publishing on things to do with the built environment or natural environment. The plan is that Australia will lead the next book. So this book was led by Aotearoa, but the next book is to be led by Australia, and Kevin O'Brien is going to lead that process, perhaps with another writer who's in this current book.
We also spoke with Patrick Stewart, one of the other editors for this publication.
Tell me a bit more about that publication, which myself and many others were involved with, and what are the longer-term plans for that?
So we have, even at this gathering, some of us have been talking about where do we go now, because the book now has been submitted for printing, and it'll be available May 15th. So that's exciting. So we'll have that in Venice for the Biennale, which we'll be at. But we're thinking volume two, we're now thinking it'll be hosted in Australia. So what we've decided is, because we're thinking of a series, so Rebecca and Kevin and myself will stay as series editors. We'll have guest editors for each volume, for the volumes. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a guest editor for Australia, and we'll have an advisory board. So, like, Ro has accepted to be on our advisory board, and we'll have Wanda, and we may have Daniel. So there's different people that we want to draw on. So that puts together a real solid team. And it's a peer-reviewed process, so it's academically a sound process. And the other two volumes will be hosted in Canada and the United States. And one of the things that we're doing with all the authors, we haven't even talked to the authors about this yet, is we want to have what we're going to call, I think, our voices collaborative. So we want to have all the authors be part of that, that contribute to the volumes, just so that we want the collaborative to own copyright. So we don't want the editor to own copyright. So that's something that we're looking at.
Our Voices, Indigeneity and Architecture is published by Oro Editions and is now available online and in bookstores. Indigenous Urbanism is a production of Te Matapihi. Sandy Wakefield does our sound recording, editing and mixing. Our theme was composed by Thomas Burton. I'm Jade Kake, your host and executive producer. For more information about today's show and other episodes of Indigenous Urbanism, go to indigenousurbanism.net. You can drop us a line at info@indigenousurbanism.net. And if you like what you're hearing, please give us a review or rating on iTunes. Coming up next on Indigenous Urbanism, we visit the site of a whānau papakāinga in Waiohiki, south of Taradale in the Hawke's Bay. It's here that the Hawaikirangi whānau of Ngāti Pārau are in the process of erecting a five-dwelling development on their ancestral land.
Seeing our houses on our whānau land, right next to our marae, and all our children, my siblings' children, playing together and growing up together, it's almost winding back time, like at the past site at Otatarapa, just across the road from us, how our tipuna used to live, you know, with their own whare, yet all these communal areas. It's like reversing the colonisation process or the urbanisation process. We've been enticed back to our land and our stories and our history. Those aspects of our life are now strengthened by being at the papakāinga, close to the marae, close to the pā site, which is now our workplace, next to the awa, which we grow plants, we grow native trees for, that we beautify the river's edge. You know, it's all encompassing.